welcome in to an episode of Light the Lamp. I'm Alexis Downey here today with a very special guest. I'm honored to be joined by Eric Duhatchik. Eric, congratulations on your retirement. 46 years as a sports writer. How does it feel?
Well, it feels pretty good. I'm still getting used to it. You know, when you have a certain routine for 46 years and then you have to establish a new routine, it can be challenging. You know, being a hockey writer is a bit like being a student, right? The season kind of gets underway after Labor Day. And nowadays, the NHL season generally goes well into June. It didn't when I first started. And then you generally have your summers off. So that's been my entire life because I went right from school into being a sports writer. And now I don't have that stability or that routine anymore. So I'm in the process of trying to find a new routine. But it's kind of you to invite me. This feels a little bit like what I used to do for a living.
Awesome to have you here in the Paul Kariya studio. What do you think about it coming in here?
Really nice. And as we were talking, you know, Paul Kariya, so in all the years that I've been covering hockey, people have often asked, you know, who are your favorite people? Who are the people that made the biggest impression on you? And I would tell you that, you know, I could name a number of coaches who taught me the game, general managers who were kind enough to share information. But in terms of players, Paul and Teemu Selänne would be for sure in the top five, especially on the on a team that I didn't cover traditionally. I mean, I covered the Calgary Flames for 20 years, and then I wrote a national column for the Globe and Mail for 17, and the last 7 years I was at the Athletic. But I always had a lot of contact with Paul because he did spend time in Calgary at the start of his career playing on the national team. And so I got to know him originally when he was playing for Canada ahead of the Olympics. And we just developed a relationship after that. And one of the smartest people that I ever met in hockey, one of the most empathetic people I've ever met in hockey. A lot of what's really great about the game is embodied in Paul Kariya. So the fact that we're in the studio named after him, that's pretty good. Now, Paul never really had the reputation of being particularly media friendly.
That's what's so funny about that.
I would be very interested in knowing how he feels about having his name on a studio, but I guess that's a question for him.
Yeah. He was a bit surprised, I think, when he came in here for the first time to join us on DuckStream. He also had some really kind words to say about you and your friendship, how he always loved talking to you about the game of hockey and how impressed he was about just your knowledge of the sport. Did you get to talk to him, I guess? Did you specifically hear from him when you announced your retirement?
Yeah. No, it was really nice. Well, first of all, the people I work for at the Athletic were very kind because a lot of times people don't get to write a farewell column or a going away column. And I told them we had an annual hockey summit at the New York Times building at the start of September. And I announced then that I was going to retire. There was one final assignment that I needed a couple of months to complete, which is why it took until November 8th to finally get out the door. But they did solicit some comments from various people, and Paul and I texted back and forth, and he congratulated me, and we've talked about it a little bit over the years because I've been in that kind of one more year syndrome that a lot of people, when you get to be my age, go through. You know, it's like, is this the year, or can I get one more year in? And inevitably, because this is a great gig, let's face it, you know, this is not hard work. It's all consuming sometimes, but it's really fun to be around the people in the game, to be at the games, to interact with them. But it felt like it was time this time. And Paul and I exchanged texts, and we're hoping to get together for dinner in the next little while. And we have a lot in common because, I'm from an immigrant family. He is as well. We both, I think we'll acknowledge that we had fairly strict upbringing. And so we have a lot of shared experiences in our past. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one reason we might have connected. But as I said, he is his own man. And I really like the way that he has just chosen the path for him. Lots of people say they want to do that. Very few people do. And the other thing that we we both agree on is that if you had taken the 10-year-old version of ourselves or the 15-year-old versions of ourselves and said, this is how life is going to unfold for you, neither of us would have believed it. It would just, it far exceeded our respective expectations. So a good man, a good man.
Your column, your final column, you know, I was fascinated by all of the things in it. I mean, you have such an amazing story. You've seen so much in your time as a sports writer. But one of the things, and you touched on it, being from an immigrant family, how English was not your first language. It was always German at home. And I was just astounded by that. It made, of course, made sense, but how you were able to fall into a career like this and, you know, be writing in English all the time.
Yeah. Well, that is the thing that, that probably surprises most people.
Yeah.
So my parents immigrated from Austria, in 1953, I was born in 55 and my parents were learning English as a second language at night school when they first arrived. And we spoke German at home because that was their first language. Mm-hmm. So on my first day of kindergarten at Franklin Public School in Toronto, I didn't know a word of English, you know, and so I would just follow the kids. It, you know, if everybody went this way, I went this way. If everybody went that way, I went that way. But when you're a child, you pick it up pretty quickly. Like my children were in French immersion in Calgary growing up. And similarly, you know, when they started school, they, you know, it was all in French and they didn't know any French and they quickly picked it up. And that's what I did too. By the time I was in grade two, I was fluent and I was a better English speaker than I was a German speaker. And in fact, you know, I was a stubborn child. And one of the things that I insisted was that I stop German school because my parents would send me on Saturdays to German school. So you'd have school from Monday to Friday. Then on Saturday, you go to German school. I wanted to play hockey on Saturday. Mm. So in time, I became such a pest that they allowed me to quit. And then, you know, hockey became part of the Saturday morning routine for me as a child growing up in Toronto. So, but yeah, it's it is remarkable because I hated writing, hated it until I was 12 or 13. And then all of a sudden something clicked and I didn't hate it as much anymore. So.
When did it click for you that you could make a career out of it?
Well, that is interesting because, finished high school, went to the University of Toronto. Halfway through, I was going to become a lawyer. But that was the 1970s when journalism had a greater stature maybe than it has right now. Woodward and Bernstein had become famous and it felt like it was a profession to, that you wanted to go into. So I investigated it in the University of Western Ontario, which has a journalism school, had a master's program there. And what they want, the theory of it was, it's really smart, is they took people with an underground background in a particular subject, and then they trained them to be journalists. And the idea was that you would develop an expertise, right? And it made sense because, you know, a lot of people just sort of drift into journalism. And so the idea was that they would take people with a science degree and they would become science reporters. They would take people with a theology degree and become, you know, a religion reporter. Well, I was an English lit major. So in theory, I was supposed to be doing, you know, movies, music, and I have written a little bit about that over time. It never worked out. Like everybody, the theology student became the music critic at our paper. You know, the English lit student became the ski writer, hockey writer. So it was a good theory. It didn't actually work out. Well, although I suppose it did. And I just started, trying to, you know, I started doing like a lot of people do when they're a student. You grab a part-time job here or, you know, a freelance assignment there. And invariably you just wait for somebody to give you that first job and then you get your foot in the door and then away you go.
And it's still like that nowadays in a lot of sense, which is, I mean, you've seen how journalism has changed over the years, but in that way, you know, what are some of still the similarities?
Well, it's a great question because I have two children, and my daughter Paula works for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Canada, and she went to the same journalism school as I did, but 39 years later, when I went to her grad, you know, I toured the facilities. We didn't, they had a studio that looked like this. There was nothing like that when I was there. So, and one of the conversations we had as she was growing up was that this is an industry that is shrinking and there aren't very many jobs. And for sure, the number of newspaper jobs has really, really gone from a time when it was a very vibrant industry when I started in the late 70s to where it is right now, where it's just kind of hanging on by a thread. So I'm very happy that she chose television because I think that there is more of a future there, but there are a very limited number of jobs and a lot of very talented people competing for those jobs. So you have to roll the dice. You have to be confident in your ability, but then somebody has to show some faith in you. And if that happens, then it's up to you at that point to prove that you can do the job.
It's special that you can kind of be a mentor for her just in some way. But for you, who was your mentor?
Well, I'm not sure if I had a mentor specifically, but what I will tell you is that when I started covering the NHL, I was only 24. So I was in over my head. I didn't know what I was doing. I'd only been 2 years in the business. And so a lot of the older hockey writers were very friendly. So Frank Orr of the Toronto Star, Fran Rosa of the Boston Globe, Bob Verdi of the Chicago Tribune, Hugh Delano of the New York Post. I remember covering my first Stanley Cup final in 80-81. And in those days, the NHL would seat you in alphabetical order. So I was sitting beside Hugh Delano on the one side and Red Fisher on the other. So Red is an icon of sports writing in Canada, but Red always had a rule where he didn't talk to rookies. And that wasn't just rookie players, it was rookie writers too. So covered an entire series and Red didn't say a word to me. And, and on the other side, you know, Hugh Delano was very friendly and follow me. And so, you know, like you had the yin and the yang of that. And I always thought, no, if I ever get to the point where, you know, where people are asking for help or whatever, I'm going to be more like the guy on my left than the guy on my right. And I've always tried to remember what that felt like when somebody was very welcoming to you in the industry, when you were still kind of finding your way, and hope that over the course of, you know, almost 50 years, if someone wanted some help, you know, I would provide it along the way.
When was your first moment that was a pinch me moment? When did it really get to you? This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm covering. I'm living my dream.
Well, I would tell you it was the Miracle on Ice. But the other thing is when you're there, you don't realize that you're witnessing history.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening? When I moved to Calgary to cover skiing, and at that time the Canadian men's downhill team was taking the ski world by storm. So it had been dominated by Switzerland, Austria, Germany, France for a long time, and then the Canadian men's downhill team in the 1970s started winning events, and one of the best skiers in the world was from Calgary, Ken Reid, and essentially I was hired to profile him. So he was going to the Olympics. He was the favorite at the Lake Placid Olympics. Didn't work out. He had a ski that came off halfway through the run and didn't medal, but one of his teammates did win the bronze medal. But because I was going to the Olympics, even as the junior writer to cover skiing, they assigned me the Canadian men's Olympic team, which was based in Calgary. So I traveled in 1979-80 hockey season with the Canadian men's team, and they played seven games against the American team. So I actually saw the American team play seven times before the Olympics, probably more than a lot of American writers. You know, there were three games in Calgary. There was a pre-Olympic tournament in Lake Placid, and then there was a tour of Minnesota and North Dakota. So I was at all of those games. So you get to the Olympics, I'm covering skiing, I'm covering figure skating, I'm covering the Canadian team, which is on the opposite side of the draw of the Americans. So I didn't cover any of the American games until Canada lost in the medal in the preliminary round. And at that point, veered over and did the final two games of the Miracle on Ice, the Friday and the Sunday. And the Friday, especially against Russia, my paper published Sunday to Friday. So the event occurred on Friday. I was writing for a Sunday paper. So you're there, but you're not under the normal deadline pressure that you would be under.
Yeah.
And the other thing about that event that people have forgotten is that Herb wouldn't let the players speak to the media during the tournament until after they beat the Russians. And they wouldn't even let them speak on the Friday. But on the Saturday afternoon, he brought everybody to the press center, which was the high school in Lake Placid. And they all sat there side by side on the stage, Herb in the middle. And then everyone had a chance to ask various questions about the event that happened. And of course, they still needed to beat the Finns the next day in order to win the gold medal, because there wasn't the single elimination that there is right now. It was like a round robin. It was based on points. So you're aware that something special is happening, but that was also the Olympics there. Eric Heiden won 5 gold medals. That felt pretty special. There were some really great moments for Canada. So it was only with the passage of time that you realized, wow, I was there for that. Are you kidding me? And,
yeah.
You know, and of course that event has taken on greater stature over the years, but it was fun as a 24-year-old kid,
wow,
junior reporter on the staff, to be there when this event unfolded.
Mm-hmm. Especially now looking back at
of course, like you said,
with everything that's happened since then. Do you keep keepsakes or your credentials or anything? You like to collect those?
I keep my credentials. That's it. I don't have a lot of anything really.
Like, yeah.
I have virtually nothing, but I have kept my credentials. So if you had given me warning, I could have brought you my Lake Placid credentials. Oh. Still have that. The ones I have in the late 70s skiing, I had a lot more hair. I was a much better looking person. So it's fun to look back on those things.
Yeah.
And those things do remind you of the various events, because I did, you know, in addition to covering the NHL for a long period of time, I did a lot of international hockey as well. And those events are, that's a different experience. But, you know, in the days when I was working for newspapers sent you everywhere. Like I covered world championships in Vienna, in Bern, during the lockout in 2004, 2005. I spent 2 weeks traveling by myself. I went to Switzerland for a week, spent 3 days with Joe Thornton and Rick Nash in Davos, hanging out with these guys. I mean, it was it was great. And then, you know, off to Sweden and, you know, covered games in Malmo and Linköping and Karlstad, where Håkan Lube was running the thing. And it was just the way things were done. And it was just a lot easier to tell stories well if your company sent you to these different events. So I always make the distinction when I reflect back that there were these great moments in the National Hockey League that I had a chance to witness. And then there were, you know, a lot at the international level as well, including, you know, a lot of the Olympics from when the NHL went in Nagano to prior to that, they had the Olympics in my hometown in Calgary, or in the town where I was working, Calgary, in 1988. So lots and lots of those experiences along the way.
And one of the parts of that is that you got to really build those relationships with all the players, the coaches, the staff, everyone being there for those events on site. How important was it for you to have those relationships, and obviously, you know, still have some of them as well?
Yeah. Well, again, I'll start with, the way we used to cover the National Hockey League. So what would happen is you traveled as a reporter. There was generally two newspapers and the radio crew. So 4 reporters traveled with the team wherever they went. And we were part of the official traveling party. So the travel secretary at the time, Al Coates, who worked here for the Ducks for a number of years and did some important work for them, would hand you a boarding card. And invariably, you might be sitting beside a player. And it was, you know, they were flying commercial in those days. So you'd have like a 4-hour flight from Calgary to Toronto. And, you know, you would just start talking like normal human beings. And I often found that the kind of informal conversation that you would have as they got to know you and you got to know them, that engendered trust. And it also, you know, if you were paying attention, would, you know, a couple of weeks down the road, you might be profiling, say, Kerry Wilson, and something that he said, you know, you follow up on. And now you have an interesting look into his life, and then you can tell his story as a hockey player. So, you know, I often have told my younger colleagues about the kind of access that we had, and they're blown away, because nowadays, you know, a lot of it's so different. You know, a lot of times, you know, they'll bring a player out of the back of the locker room to give an interview. There'll be a battery of microphones and unfamiliar faces. And, you know, I find a lot of times they're very careful in their interviews, and they're not really giving up very much, especially post game. So, we didn't have that. We traveled with the team. They knew who we were. You know, I always kind of joke that Jim Poplinski, a real prankster on the team, what he would do is, everyone had a check bag. And so he would collect a dollar from everybody, players, you know, training staff, coaches, And then the first bag down the carousel won the pot, $25 or whatever it was. And he treated us like a player. You know, aww. You had to pony up your dollar just like every other player, trainer.
Did you ever win?
Never one single time. Never.
Oh no.
And I don't think I think it was probably good that I didn't, because I'm sure that would have the amount of grief that I would have had to take if I'd won one of those things. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been worth it in the end for the small paltry sum that you would have won anyway. So
you've talked about how the coverage of hockey has changed, but the sport has changed a lot, and you've witnessed that throughout your career. What stands out on that end?
Well, I for me, there's a certain full circle element to it, because if you think about hockey in the 1980s, so again, I was based in Calgary. That was the heyday of the Edmonton Oilers. So the Battle of Alberta was at its peak. You know, Calgary had a very good team during that period of time, but Edmonton had a team for the ages. So, you know, Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Yari Curry, Paul Coffey, Kevin Lowe, Grant Fuhr. I mean, they were outstanding. And Calgary had some very good teams too. So there were some unbelievable playoff series between those teams, and very high scoring. I still think 1985 was probably the highest scoring year in history of the National Hockey League on a goals per game basis. So that was really exciting, you know, a back and forth exchanging chances, kind of a style of play. And that went away in the mid 90s. And my friend and colleague Michael Farber, you know, coined the term the dead puck era. But that's really what happened, you know, from about the mid 1990s when New Jersey won its first cup, right into, you know, the period of time where they had the lockout and quote, fix the game. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't very exciting. There was a lot of plotting going on. Skill was not allowed to assert itself. And then gradually skill has come back into the game. And so I think where we're at today is where we were at the start of my career. And that's a good thing. Mm. But and there was that this period, this lull in the middle where the, you know, the game just wasn't very exciting to watch for a fan. It wasn't very much fun to cover as a reporter. And, you know, it was a good thing that they, you know, they injected a little bit of life back into it, because, you know, the product right now is fantastic and the skill level is really, really high.
What did you turn to through those times where it was a little difficult to cover? What did you rely on for, you know, your columns and your relationships with some of the staff and players?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that didn't change. I mean, you still reported on the game, whether it was a 2-1 game or an 8-7, but I would say if you go back and look at those stories, there was a fair bit more criticism of the style of play. Mm. And I will tell you that, you know, there was a period of time there where, you know, the genuine pleasure that you had going to the rink for a game, that excitement had disappeared. Mm. And, you know, never to the point where it's like, okay, do I want to do something else? But I was losing interest in the game. Actually, the thing that got me back excited about the game was when my son started to play. And because I was, you know, traveling with the team, I could never be the head coach of a team, but I always volunteered as an assistant coach. Mm. And when I was in town, I was on the ice with them, and seeing the palpable excitement of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year olds. My son played until he was 17. It got my passion back. Mm. But I was losing it for sure. And part of it had to do with the monotony of the game that, you know, that was there for a period of time.
One of the big parts of your career, of course, getting the Elmer Ferguson Award, a Hockey Hall of Fame, a part of the selection committee. You mentioned that too. How was it through the years being a part of that selection committee and then of course winning that award?
Well, yeah. So the award came first. That was a complete surprise because it came in 2001. I mean, I felt like I was in the heart of my career at that point. And so I was at the Stanley Cup final that year. And I remember Frank Brown from the NHL came up to me. I was sitting next to Mike Farber and he says, "Congratulations." And I said, "Thanks." And, you know, and then he gave me a quizzical look and walked away. And I turned to Michael and I said, "What for?" You know, and I'm running through my mind, did I write something? And I really couldn't think of anything that I'd written recently that was memorable. So the next day, the Hall of Fame put out the press release and I was completely gobsmacked. I was 45, so the youngest writer to ever win the award. And it just felt, truthfully, it felt too soon. Mm. and I, you know, it's a, but it's a peer award, right? So it's voted on by your peer group. So the people who read you all the time and evaluate your work and compete against you. So, you know, to me, that's the greatest honor you can have mm-hmm. when your peers select you for that. So, I was gracious, I think, and humble but what I will tell you is my father was still alive at the award ceremony, and that was really important to my family. Mm-hmm. So if it had happened later and after we'd lost Dad, it wouldn't have meant the same thing. So that was great. And then so I got that. And then a few years later, Bill Hay, who unfortunately just recently passed away, the chairman of the selection committee, called me and said that there was going to be an opening for mm-hmm. a writer, because Kevin Allen, who was on the selection committee, was working for a paper, USA Today, and they had a policy that prevented him from serving on the committee. So he had to resign, and they were looking for a replacement. And was I interested? And I said, yes. But I was working for the Globe and Mail, you know, the Canada's national newspaper at the time. And I said, I'm going to have to vet it through our people as well, because they may give me the same answer that USA Today gave Kevin. So I ran it past them, and they went up the flagpole and they said, no, it's fine. So I accepted, and I joined in 2004. And I remember my first meeting, I was sitting beside John Davidson on the one side. John and I were doing television together. So I was clinging to him for support. And on the other side was Stan Mikita. So as a kid growing up in Toronto, yeah. Stan Mikita was one of the all-time greats, very popular player, fantastically charismatic. You know, he and Bobby Hull were the face of the Chicago Blackhawks for the entire era that I was growing up. So to be sitting beside Stan Mikita and about to vote on the Hall of Fame class in 2004 was just like, you know, I always say, you know, if there had been like a camera at the top of the room, they would have gone around the room and say, okay, Harry Sinden, let me know why he's here, Serge Savard, Pat Quinn. And then the camera would have, what's that guy doing there? What's he doing here? He doesn't belong. And that's how you feel at the beginning. You're all of the people that were sitting there at the table, Dick Irv and Frank Selke Jr., Frank Advari, Marty Pavlich. I mean, mm-hmm. people who were, wow. you know, in their 70s and 80s, I was 40 something, and just felt like, again, you know, what am I doing here? But what happens is over time, you start to get a bit more confident mm-hmm. and you find your voice in that. And then the next thing you know, 15 years have gone by and you've reached your term limit. And it's like, what, you're retiring me now? I have to leave? That was the hardest thing in 2018, because you're only allowed to serve 15 years. And when I got to that limit, I was like, oh, I'm probably okay with leaving. And then the next year they had the meeting. I was like, oh, I want to be in that meeting.
You missed out. Yeah.
But it was a one day a year, fascinating discussion. Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to go into the details because you have to, of course, sign a confidentiality agreement. But, you know, you can certainly look at the people who were elected during the time I was on the committee. Two of my favorite people, as I mentioned before, Paul and Teemu Selanne were elected. A number of the really great Edmonton and Calgary players that I had a chance to cover were elected during that period of time. So it was a great experience, challenging. Mm-hmm. Everybody in that room is strong-willed. And one of the hardest things to do is to convince someone who's strong-willed to change their minds. Like mm-hmm. it sounds simple, but it isn't. You know, people come in there with very firm opinions about things, and in order to build the consensus that you need to get someone elected to the Hall of Fame, you need 14 out of 18 votes. You have to reasonably make an argument, and sometimes you do have to get people to change their mm-hmm. minds. So when you succeed in doing that, then that's very satisfying. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you saw so much in just your time there. It's so awesome. You touched on Paul and Teemu, and yeah. I know that, you know, you mentioned to me before this, you were there for Teemu's last game, but yeah. what were some of the great moments that you got to see on the Ducks end?
Oh yeah. Well, I love covering the Ducks. You know, to me, well, so when I was at the Globe and Mail, I was writing a national column, and the Ducks were a really good team for a really long time. So, I covered an awful lot of their playoff series. I was there in 2003 mm-hmm. In that seven-game final against New Jersey. I was there the night that they lost in New Jersey. I remember a number of us were sitting around the press room before the game, and we were on the Conn Smythe committee. Mm. It was 12 of us. discussing what we're going to do, because that was the year, of course, that J.S. Jaguar had that fantastic playoff. And New Jersey, while they had a good team, it was a very balanced team. And there were, you know, many, many players on that team that contributed to where they got to. So the discussion basically was, you know, unless something dramatic happens, Jaguar is going to win this, even if the Ducks don't end up winning the game, which they didn't. And so I know that was a bit controversial, because rarely does a player on a losing team win the Conn Smythe, but he was the dominant player in the playoffs. And that, you know, I always found when you were voting for either awards or if you were on a committee like this, you read, what are we voting for? What are we voting for? And the Conn Smythe goes to the player who was the most dominant in the playoffs. 8 weeks, not one day.
Yeah.
8 weeks. And that was J.S. Jaguar. So that was interesting. And then, of course, 4 years later, when Anaheim won, okay, now we're voting on Anaheim. Who do you vote? You know, it could have been Pronger. You know, could have been Sammy Paulson. But, you know, we settled on Niedermayer. And I always felt like, you know, he would have been the choice from New Jersey. And we kind of owed him, you know, like he should have got half a Conn Smythe there. So, and he was. I mean, he was fantastic on that team that won the championship in 2007. So I know that, you know, the hit on Paul from Scott Stevens in that 03 series was one of the hardest stories to cover, because that kind of thing shouldn't happen and doesn't happen anymore, or not very much anymore. But I think that is one of the things that has improved in the National Hockey League significantly in the time that I was doing it. What used to be considered a legal hit isn't anymore. And you know, it took too long, I believe, for the mentality to change. But I think that the awareness now of concussions and, you know, I think they could still go further, frankly, but it is better than before. And, you know, when you're trying to make changes in anything, sometimes it just requires a series of small steps to finally get to where you need to be. But yeah, seeing, you know, Paul like that on the ice was really, really tough. And that just shouldn't happen. That doesn't belong in the game. I think most people realize that. So so that was unhappy. But Teemu's final game, boy, he's such a charismatic personality.
And
so what I would tell you is, I was covering Teemu like literally right from the start, because not a lot of people know this. When Teemu was drafted by the Winnipeg Jets, he signed his first contract with the Calgary Flames. The Flames gave him an offer sheet and he signed it. And for what was considered huge money at the time, $1.2 million. But the coach in Calgary at the time was Dave King, a former coach of Canada's Olympic team, who was very well-versed in European hockey, had tons of contacts there. And they said to him, this guy is going to be special. So the Flames took the unprecedented step of signing him to the offer sheet, which, of course, Winnipeg matched. And then when Teemu came over, he had 76 goals in his first year, and you know, eventually got traded here, and the rest is history. But just because he signed that original offer sheet, I remember writing the news story about that, I had an awareness and an interest in his career right from the start. And you could see almost from the get-go that he was going to be a star. So he had not just ability, but charisma. And those are the two things that, you know, he just lights up a room. Still does.
He still does.
I saw him at the Hall of Fame. So a week ago, I was at the 2024 Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, and Teemu was staying at the same hotel as me. Chris Pronger was. We were waiting in the coffee line with Chris and talking about his life and times. Another enormously interesting character. You know, they don't make them like Chris Pronger anymore, unfortunately. So
now that you're going into retirement, you going to still be watching a lot of hockey? But now you get the fan side of it, kind of.
Yeah, that's a good question. I watched the Ducks win last night against Dallas.
Nice.
So I guess the answer is yes. You know, a friend of mine who retired a couple of years ago said, now you're going to have more time to devote to your fantasy hockey team.
Oh.
And I have to tell you, I do have Lukas Dostal on everyone. Oh. I'm looking like a genius, you know, but again, you know,
love it.
Watched him lots in the last few years.
Yeah.
Think this guy's going to be really special. Is already, but he's just starting to scratch the surface there. And I drafted Cutter Gauthier this year, a little slow start, but I'm seeing things that I like. I like from him, and you know, and of course, that young defense has a chance to be really good if they if they continue to develop. You know, I often think about you know, what was the hallmark of a lot of the really good Ducks teams, right? And when you think about, you know, the Cam Fowler and Hampus Lindholm and Shea Theodore, Josh Manson, you know, that those really good teams were backed by a terrific defense. I think the Trent Yawney was the coach that was in charge of the defense at the time. He's kind of like a defense whisperer wherever he goes. He was, I think, responsible for helping, you know, when he was an assistant with the Kings, you know, Mikey Anderson, Sean Walker, Sean Durzi, all these players that didn't have the greatest pedigree became very good NHL players because they had good coaching. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that the Ducks have a core of young players. If they are coached the right way and developed the right way, they're going to be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. We're looking forward to the future here. A lot of bright moments that we've seen in the games and this season, and a lot to build for coming up. But Eric, one more for you. I know I just kind of asked you about retirement, but you're going to be playing tennis. So what's the plan now?
Well, that's what I've been saying. Yeah, that, you know, my wife is a top tennis player. And
she's playing
in 9,000 different leagues in California and in Calgary. I don't play competitively anymore, but our matches are very competitive, and we're pretty evenly matched. And so, yeah, on the days that we're not on the tennis court, we're probably on the golf course. Or, you know, I was a fairly serious runner at one point. Don't run as much anymore, but I'm going to see if my body holds up. You know, I'm only, like, I'll be able to compete in 70 and older in a year. And I can't wait to move up, because 60 to 70 is really, really tough. All those 60-year-olds who retire, all they do is run, you know, and you know, you're working a full-time job. And you're trying to fit your training in. It's not a fair fight, but it's going to be a fairer fight in a year or so. So I'll see what happens. But I'm hoping that my body holds up and I can start, you know, running a bit more seriously again.
Well, enjoy it. Congratulations on an amazing career, Eric. It's so awesome to have you in the studio to talk about it all. And we're looking forward to just, you know, seeing your next path.
All right. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on DuckStream.